Big topic. Partly, I just want to cover, because I can't do how you can create tax-exempt charitable Section 501c3 organization without first talking about, do you really want it? Are you that sure that you want that, that you don't want a business corporation, that you don't want to look at what we are calling the new hybrid types? I am a little bit skeptical about those, but I'd be happy to answer questions about them from anybody who would like them. Massachusetts this summer passed a statute permitting a benefit corporation to be created under Massachusetts law. I'm not persuaded we needed it, because I think you could do it under existing laws here if you wrote your documents correctly. But there are these new forms that allow you to look at more than just your stockholders and providing benefits to them. And they talk about them in terms of providing benefit to the public. And then within that, you can provide benefits to specific segments of the public. So that in a sense, you can frame a charitable purpose, or a social purpose is what it's called, and therefore you will be considered to have duties to both the beneficiaries of that purpose and the general public. And the structure is very complicated, and I strongly suggest that if you are interested in something of that nature, and it's not just Massachusetts, New York passed the statute, California has a statute, Illinois passed. Those are the bigger states that have it now. And it's going to, there is a movement behind the passage of these statutes, which is called the B-Lab. And I recommend that website to any of you who are interested in that type of a corporation. There is no reason that you can't create a limited liability company and have social purposes for that. And again, that will require some language that you have thought through as to what you want to do and what you want to accomplish. The first thing I think you have to think about when you're thinking about a tax-exempt organization, a C3, or these other forms is, what do you really want? What do you really want to accomplish? Is your first interest your family, the appreciation, you and your family? Nothing wrong with it. You want the money. You want to be able to sell this company, or you want to be able to take out of it the appreciation and take out of it the profits. And if you feel that way, then absolutely look at one of these companies, and including just a straight business corporation. There's nothing wrong with it. You can do good social work with a business corporation. However, if you have decided that those are not your private inner goals and that you really want to produce something that will be a permanent benefit to society and to this charitable mission that you have, then you do want to think about creating a tax-exempt nonprofit organization that is exempt from taxes under what we call Section 501c3 of the Internal Revenue Code, and that will be eligible to receive tax-deductible contributions from individuals, from foundations, from corporations. That fits with another part of what you have to think about, which is, where are you going to get to finance it? And that's going to happen whether you think it's going to be a for-profit or a non-profit. But your sources are going to be different, because in your non-profit, you are not going to have private investors to whom you will be responsible, but also who will be looking to take a share of the profits from your enterprise. We say one other thing, and it's that people don't think about it, but it is perfectly legal and okay to create a nonprofit And while your nonprofit is functioning, for it to create in turn a for-profit. And if you have a project that you think might do better not within your nonprofit enterprise, then under certain circumstances and with some restrictions, you can do this different kind of hybrid, and you've always been able to do it, and there is nothing that will prevent you from doing it if you follow the right steps. And what I mean by the right steps is that you are always protecting the interests of the charity. And when we're going to start our nonprofit, what you need to do is a combination of state law and federal law. And the two fit together. I did a chart for our students once where I had IRS and 501c3 up here, but then I had state law here and federal law here, the Internal Revenue Code, and showing how they meet. And the way they meet is as follows. You create a corporation under the law of the state where you think you're going to be operating primarily. And sometimes that can be Delaware, even though you're not going to be operating there primarily. A lot of New York lawyers, almost all the New York lawyers will start a Delaware corporation because the New York nonprofit corporation law is very complicated and requires some approvals. If you have something that's like educational or art, you have to go to the Regents for a separate. Massachusetts doesn't work that way. Very few states work that way. The states that are active in regulation of charities, and I don't mean this in a bad sense. In fact, sometimes I think you're better off in a state where there is good regulation because it tends to keep you on your toes and people respect you for being in that state. And I do say Massachusetts, but Illinois, California, Ohio, Michigan, those are the states, New Hampshire, that have registration and reporting and active programs in the Office of the Attorney General. I'm going to do one quick little step into history because the laws that we deal with in the states, and they have their precedent also in the Internal Revenue Code, which in the regulations refers to the Statute of Elizabeth of 1602, which is called the Statute of Charitable Uses. And it is in that statute that we find the recitation of charitable purposes that is still valid today. And this is a very interesting tradition that has come through the common law, and the purposes of education and religion and support of and health and support of arts and culture all can be traced back to the early cases that represented talking about in the cases British charitable trusts in those days and corporations. And that is what we look to today when we're defining what is a charitable purpose. So to create a charity, you first have to create a 501c3 to get your tax exemption. You have to create a valid charity under state law, and that means getting a corporate charter from the state under the provisions of the state nonprofit corporation law. Those are easy. It will say, what's your purpose? What's your name? What's your purpose? Will you have members? Name your directors, secretary, trust, treasurer. Some states you can have only one person, although the IRS frowns on that strongly. What's your calendar year or fiscal year, and your place where you're going to operate? Well, that's fine, and you look at that in itself and you say, okay, that's easy. However, when you go to look at the federal rules, there are what they call organizational test. And it's organizational requirements that say that you are not entitled to exemption unless you state in your articles of organization first, that your purposes follow the federal purposes, but as I said, that's usually not a problem. But that you have special language that some of you have heard of, no part of the net earnings of the corporation shall inure to a private shareholder or person, and you may not use any but insubstantial amounts for lobbying, and that you may not, absolutely not, participate in any campaign for public office. So that's the first thing there that you're going to look at and think, oh, well, I want to do some lobbying, am I going to be able to do that or not? Generally speaking, for most charities, it's not going to be a problem. If it is a problem, you can set up a tax-exempt organization under Section C-4 that is controlled by your charity, and that can do any amount of lobbying. You're just going to keep the funds separate, and you do not, donors do not get deductions for their contributions to C-4s. So I'm still on, what we're talking about is that state line of what you're doing, but you're going to have in your documents the requirements from the IRS. And the crucial one, I said, is that magic language. You also want to say that your purposes will exercise your purposes exclusively. And that is, doesn't mean that you can't have a little bit of what might be called a trade or business. But the language says, exclusive, the regulations say, we don't really mean that. It can be a little bit. The other thing that is important is that, and this had to do with what I was talking about, the difference between a C3 and a for-profit, you have to have a provision, and Mass state law and some other states have this that would apply anyway, but that if the corporation is dissolved, then the assets have to go to another organization that is exempt at that time. Now, state law provides the same thing for charitable corporations. State law says a nonprofit charitable corporation cannot dissolve unless you are in court and the court is directing that your assets are preserved for charitable purposes. And so these two laws mesh, but again, because of the way the Internal Revenue Code is set up, you've got to meet that organizational test, so that your documents have to have those magic words in them. Once you put that together, you also need bylaws, and the bylaws are going to tell you who are your directors, how are they elected, what is their term, how many meetings you have a year. You must have an annual meeting. You can have a meeting by telephone if you specified it. So there are certain things like that that you need some guidance. There are a lot of models. The best thing I can advise for you is, well, there are two things. The Attorney General's office in the states I've mentioned and in a number of others will have information for you helping you to create these corporations. The other place where you can get that is from the Secretary of State's office, because that's where you file your articles of organization to get created. IRS.gov is probably the best resource you're going to find anywhere. And do any of you know about it? Okay. I cannot recommend it highly enough. They give you, and you go into charities, and you will find not only all the steps, you will find the samples of a state trust document, of a state articles of organization document. You will find, because you need nowadays for the federal, you need to have adopted a conflict of interest policy. You need to have adopted a whistleblower policy that came out of Sarbanes-Oxley, but applies to, it's one of the few that applies across the board. So all your filing for the state is electronic. You can get it almost overnight. As long as you followed their checklist and you've answered all, you filled in all the places, then you will get your corporate articles of organization approved. You also will need to apply for a federal employee identification number. And that, again, is electronic. It should be done as soon as you've created your corporation. And in the meantime, while you're putting all of this together, you are going to be working on something called an application for exemption, which is Form 1023. And again, IRS.gov has it. I downloaded one today because it has updated information for changes from the form. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about that. But first, I wanted to just go through for you and with you purposes under which you need to have fit your mission. And let me just say that one of the crucial things in the application for exemption is that you will be asked to describe how you are going to carry out your purposes. And they don't want you to use any language that's in your documents. They want you to give your sense of how you are going to do this. So that all of this is thinking, but if you've got the form and you know where you're going, it should help to help your focus. And all of these questions are going to force you to think about, am I doing this the right way? Am I going to be able to raise the money that I think I am? And I'm not going to be able to talk to you about that beyond the fact that probably, as all of you know, number one, before you really jump into this, is you should have thought through and been realistic about what you're going to be able to do to support the organization. And when I mean supported, I mean you can have a salary, it can be reasonable, it doesn't have to be peanuts at all. You can have help, you must follow the employment requirements for employees. But when I say charitable, I mean it in a sense that is much larger than relief of the poor. And this, I referred to it in a sense under the Statute of Elizabeth, but charitable in the legal sense, in the Division of Public Charities in the Office of the Attorney General in Massachusetts, all of this comes from that concept of charitable, which for your federal purposes under the regulations describes religious, charitable, scientific, testing for public safety, literary, educational, or prevention of cruelty to children or animals. These other things came in, as you can see under, or think about, that somebody got interested that maybe it couldn't, you couldn't have an exempt charity for prevention of cruelty to animals, so they put it as an amendment to the Internal Revenue Code. As I said, you must serve a public, not a private interest. You may not have private enurement or benefit, which means passing off any, what they would call, excess benefits. Your dealings with the charity must be at fair market value if you're going to sell something to the charity. You're not prevented from doing that, but you must have it at fair market value. There must be only insubstantial lobbying and no campaigning. Now, it also is, the law has always been, that you are not limited by those purposes as long as you can show that a purpose fits within the general framework of that. And so that over the years, and it's been interesting because the British have just adopted a new definition of charity, because they were much slower than we were in the courts being ready to expand the definition. So that environmental protection, disaster relief, public interest law firms, cultural organizations of all sorts, housing and community development, were not necessarily considered charities at the beginning of the 20th century, but there's no question that then, of course, they are now. The concerns that the IRS has now, as a matter of fact, will reflect, as I say it to you, what is current: overseas operations and terrorist activities. and there are some special rules that you would be required if you were found to be making grants to anybody that's on the list of terrorist organizations. Another limits are that an intended purpose is invalid if it is unlawful or otherwise contrary to fundamental public policy. That is the ruling from the courts that made a school that discriminated against blacks to forced it to lose its tax exemption. And that was a major issue in the, well, about 1970. And then the other, so the discrimination is considered against public policy, and therefore in your Form 1023, if you're going to be a school, they're going to ask you how your policies fit to show that you are not discriminating. And they will even ask you about sometimes the size and complexity of the student body. And of course, if you think about it, I can remember once doing an application for a nursery school in a very small community in a farming town. And of course, they were only for the children of the families there, so it wasn't you weren't going to be able to answer the question about how the distribution showed that you were not discriminating, but the service is sensitive enough to understand that. So there is one other part to this process that I do want to talk about, and that has to do with the governance structure, and in a sense I mentioned that in terms of what had to be in the Articles of Organization and Bylaws of who are your directors, how are they elected, do you have members who elect the directors, what term of office do they have. When you're starting out, it's perfectly okay for you to have you and a close friend and a family member. And nobody's going to say you can't do it, but you're going to be looked at much more carefully than otherwise. And the exemption application, never had it before, but right now it asks about your relationships to the people who will be on your board and also and their families, and also people with whom you will be doing major business. So this is a major decision that you make. As I said, when you go this route, you are giving up certain parts of independence. And one of them is that you need to share the power of governing this organization with other people. And so you need to pick these people carefully. You don't need many. It's certainly starting out. You can do it with three and then say you're going to expand from there. But you really have to have thought that through. And what you really need to think through in a different sense is who's going to help the organization and who among your acquaintances or who, and I've seen this happen, who do you know who could really help you? Who, it might be a long shot, it might not be somebody you know very well, but it never hurts to ask someone. And if there could be people who think your mission is very important, they like what you're doing, and they will help you. One thing that we suggest as you grow is that you keep your board small and that you have a board of advisors or a board of visitors. It has various names. But bring people in that way who can help you, who will not take the responsibility of being on the board. Because being a director means committing yourself to attend meetings, to participate in every part of the activities that you're asked to do, and to supervise what is going on at a policy level. You're not doing the day-to-day as a director. There's a tension here that some people overdo their role as a director. But so it's really important to be able to have thought through who's going to help you, who's not going to try to take over, to who is going to be your support. And remembering that on the record, you're going to be talking about relationships among the people who are your fiduciaries. Sometimes people, and there are large boards, and you all know some of them, where you ask Mr. X to be on because he's a big potential donor, and you ask Mrs. Y to come on your board because she has a large circle of women friends, this isn't so much these days, but it used to be, who she can call on, who if you want to do an event to raise money, she would be helpful. And sometimes someone will say, well, I'll come on because I know that my name will help you and I want the public to know that I am a donor, but I'm not going to be able to come to meetings and I'm not going to be able to really, I'll do just that thing. Not legal. Nobody, it's hard for that to be said that firmly, but that is the law, that when you accept to be the role of a director, which is a fiduciary, you have obligations that don't let you just compartmentalize what you're going to do for the entity. And that's important because people like that ultimately are not going to be the ones you really want to have helping you move your organization forward. How am I doing for time?
Okay. No, you're okay. Yeah.
Yeah,
you should probably leave it maybe 20 minutes.
Yeah, that's what I want to do. So, so we are now, as I said, on, we've gone through the organizational test. The other part of it that is important when you're getting started is you want somebody to help you if you can't do it on your own, set up your books, your records, your accounts in a way that will make sense going forward. And make sure you have somebody who is truly responsible. It's, if you can afford it, the best thing to do is to get an accountant in early. And sometimes you'll find that someone who will be willing to go along with you for a time and with the hopes that you will become a permanent client. But even an initial consultation with a professional of that nature, and also someone who understands about really keeping books in a way that are going to make it possible for you to file the annual information returns that you will be you have now committed to provide to the Internal Revenue Service once you get your determination of tax exemption. So that is a sense, those are a sense of the responsibilities that you're taking on that I'm weaving into this application process because they follow and in a sense they make you think about what you're doing. So when we get to the 1023 application, you are going to have to, as I said, describe how you're going to carry out your purposes. You will have to say how you expect your organization to be financed. Are you going to solicit funds from the public? If you are, will you be using a paid fundraiser? And if that's the case, what is the kind of an arrangement you have with that paid fundraiser? There is from time to time, and there is a recent it was an article in the Wall Street Journal just this last week, I think it came out, talking about the percentage, it was about the telephone fundraisers, telephone solicitors, and how large a cut they get. If you give $100 to X whose phone called you on the phone, that often as little as 20% or 30% is going to be going to the charity. And people, some people just don't understand this. But the Internal Revenue Service and the state agencies are going to want to know what you're doing or what you're planning to do. The other thing is that if you haven't started operating, they're going to want 4 years of estimated financials. And it can be a guess. I think this is one of the hardest things for people to do because you just don't know. But you are required to make the best informed estimate you can. And nobody's gonna go back at you if you don't make it. But they want to see that you've thought through where your expenses are going to be and whether you think you're going to be a viable organization. It's a weeding process. And so that you have to do that. I mentioned that you will have to have a conflict of interest policy. The IRS has been interested in the last 2 years or three in governance procedures, and those questions have come into the 1023 application for exemption and the annual report, which is, we call Form 990 of one form or another. And so they are going to ask, how do you or will you set the compensation of your directors and officers? They're particularly interested in making sure that the officer's compensation is understood by the full board. There's been a number of cases. We had one here where actually the Attorney General in Massachusetts forced major changes in the governance of Boston University, because a small group of people were setting the president's salary, which was very, very high, and he was forced to give back some funds. And you don't obviously want to get yourself into that, even if it's at the lower end of the scale. They're looking at what is reasonable, what is comparable. And as you get bigger, they will look to you to find the comparables, and they can be, under the statute, they can be in any part of the universe, but in general, you'd be expected to look at comparables within the nonprofit sector. There are special schedules to the Form 1023 that have to do with schools, organizations, schools, colleges, and universities. That's where I talked about the racial category, student body, faculty, hospitals and medical research organizations. Hospitals will be required to show that they are providing some public benefit or a charity. If you're creating a health organization and you expect to have all of your reimbursement come from Medicare, Medicaid, then they will want to know what you are doing, care for the poor, community. One of the requirements used to be that if you were a hospital, you had to have an emergency room, but that didn't work in a place where there were three of them in one part of the city, which could have happened in Boston. So that has been broadened, but it still is something that you need to think about. There are organizations that are exempt because they support other charities, and then homes for the elderly or handicapped or low-income housing, and that's a separate schedule with questions on it, and two others. One is successors to other organizations, and I didn't mention at the outset, but some people who start a charitable organization will decide that they really don't want to go through this whole process that I've been describing, and they will seek to find what they call a fiscal sponsor. Does this mean anything to any of you? Not many. Okay. Well, there are some larger tax-exempt charitable organizations that will agree to serve as the parent, in a way, of a new charity. And that means that the term they use is a fiscal sponsor. And you could be your own separate organization, but they will put you as part of theirs for reporting purposes. And you will need to file information and everything with them. You're responsible to them. But you are piggybacking on their tax exemption until you're on your feet. And then you can go off on your own. At that point, you apply for exemption. if you file this Form 1023 that I'm talking about within 27 months of getting created, which means when your articles of organization came through, your exemption will go back to the first day that you were created. And that's important if you know that, because there will be some donors who will be willing to bet on you, in the sense that even if you don't have the determination ruling, they'll make a contribution to you and know that you're going to get it, in the sense that even if you get questions from the IRS, you're still going to get that exemption. And that their contributions will be deductible, even though they don't, you don't have the ruling in hand. There are others who are going to say, no, we're not going to give you anything until we get the you get your determination. In those cases, if you have a fiscal sponsor, you can make the gift to the sponsor and earmark it for the organization that you have created, and it will be deductible. So that they are not easy to come by, but they're I'm not going to remember the name of it, but there is one national organization, something like Evergreen. Just anybody who wants me to, I can tell you another time. But I think if you just Google fiscal sponsors or fiscal sponsorship, you'll find. And there may even be some local ones.
So Phillips Brooks House does it for
Yes, they
the
do,
college.
exactly. And that's within the college, yeah. Now they'll do it for groups that aren't even exempt. It's a little bit broader, but when you get out in the other world, there are some that do this. And that is a help, but it's not something that happens for everybody. But in that case, you will be asked if you were the successor to another organization or if you had a relationship to another organization. So that in your application for exemption, they're going to want to know what you've been doing from the beginning. And you just say, well, we've been sponsored by X organization. And that is how you get around that. If you've operated as a for-profit and you then decide to become non-profit, perfectly okay to do that. You change your articles or organization or start a new one, but they will ask you, what were you doing in the old organization? And they're going to want to know why you changed. And they're looking, obviously, for places where somebody thought that they could possibly get a grant that they couldn't have gotten as a for-profit, and they want to be sure that the successor organization is going to be meeting the requirements of a tax-exempt charity.
Okay, Marian, now you have 15 minutes.
Okay. Then I'm going to say very quickly that organizations operating abroad are going to be looked at carefully, and you will be asked about whether you're going to be working with organizations in the non-U.S. country that would be exempt if they were in the United States. Would they be, for example, in India? The India law follows the British, and they have charities, and they have certain regulations for charities, so that if you're going to be doing a program in India, you would be able to say that you're going to be working with that organization. Assuming everything goes smoothly, and you've not raised any question or not given any information that raises a question, you will get a determination letter that will say that you are exempt, that you have to file X kind of a Form 990 every year, and certain other limits. I haven't talked about private foundations. That's a whole separate regime with its own. A private foundation has to meet all the requirements we're talking about here that I mentioned. But in addition, there are extra rules. There are further limits on what they can do. And in your Form 1023, you have to explain why you're not a private foundation. And that has to do, for most of the organizations, with a money test, that you are getting most of your support not from one family for one other foundation. So once you're functioning, the things I really just want to talk to you about very quickly are annual filing requirements. If your gross receipts are under $50,000, then you file a postcard saying you're in existence. If you're in one of the states I mentioned, you have to file a financial report, even if you're $50,000 and under. $50,000 to $200,000 gross receipts or assets of $990,999. You file what they call a Form 990-EZ, which is a simpler form than the full-fledged 990, and that will come when you're getting really successful and your gross receipts are $200,000 or more. You have $1 million or more in assets. And that's the one that will ask the governance questions and a whole lot of all of these things. You also will have to file every year that you're in existence with the Secretary of State. That just says who you are and who your directors are. If you are going to be soliciting funds from the general public, there are 36 states that have separate rules where you have to register, you have to tell them that what you're doing, you have to agree in some states that you will tell potential contributors that they can get information on your finances from your organization. They're very separate rules. And undertaking a national fundraising campaign can be very arduous because of these rules. And there's a separate set of rules if you're going to do internet solicitations. Finally, I just want to tell you about some resources that are available. And I think the most important one is the iLab, and I hope you all know about the iLab. It's the new Harvard University facility to help entrepreneurs, and they are available to help you whether you want to do a for-profit or a non-profit. And they have even legal office hours, and different firms from around the city send their lawyers, and you can make appointments to get help, which is a terrific resource. The Harvard Law School clinics help new people trying to start new social adventures or nonprofits. The rest of our Hauser series is going to have people who will be very helpful, and particularly I think the best person I know on finances is Jim Honan. He's speaking, and then Bill Ryan is also going to be speaking. But all of the topics will help you if you're interested in this. And they're on the website.
They are, and I actually have handouts here.
So. Perfect. Yeah. Wonderful. And Boston Bar Association will help you. There's a facility. There's some volunteer lawyers at the Massachusetts Bar Association. And there'd be the same things in other states and other schools. So there is help. And very often, law firms will allow some of their young lawyers to act pro bono to help create an organization because they have a personal interest in it. And it's helpful for the law firm if the lawyer goes through the process. So those are things that I hope will be helpful for you. I hope what I've said makes some sense, and I'd love to answer questions. Right here, and then behind. You go ahead.
At the very beginning of your talk, you said, forgive me if I paraphrase you wrong, but that in some ways maybe a lot of the B Corp work is unnecessary because there are ways of incorporating certain wording in your articles of incorporation or whatever document to preserve the social purpose of a for-profit organization.
Yes.
I was hoping you could talk more specifically about what some of those are, particularly in regard to stuff that has teeth after either founding leaders leave or as ownership of the company is kind of divvied up by investors.
Well, an LLC, you could certainly do it. That's a limited liability company. It's a newer form. It really, many people prefer that to a business corporation now. And it's taxed as a partnership. It's a flow through. and like, or a subchapter C corporation, meaning that the corporation is not taxed at the corporate level. It goes through to the owners. And there are certain states where the B-Lab actually has a list of states where this, like Delaware has a case that we think is a little bit obsolete, but it says that the purpose of the business corporation is to benefit stockholders. And if you have something that's explicit, then it's a little bit hard to fudge around unless you just want to make... you still have to look at your stockholders, and you couldn't just do everything on the basis that they were going to do no dividends and it's all going to be social work. So those are the two best places, is with a state that we think allows it, and the other is an LLC in every state. California has something now called a flexible corporation, which is a little bit easier than a benefit corporation. B, this is kind of confusing. A B corporation is a corporation, it can be a business corporation, that has been certified by an organization called B-Lab, that's purpose is to get more corporations certified that they're doing good. And they can be business corporations. But they have been promoting the benefit corporation statutes. And the benefit corporation statute requires you have a benefit director, a benefit officer. It talks about liability. And in it, if the stockholders vote, it's a supermajority vote, but they can lose the benefit designation. So you have no guarantee that you're going to, as you said, when the initial people are gone, it can go back to being a straight business corporation. So your only guarantee of that is if you have a charity. And the state courts, as I said, will enforce that. And the IRS requires that you have in your articles that you have to, you are subject to those state laws.
So then it sounds like the responsibility is to manage your shareholders more so than pick the magical form of incorporation or form of business formation.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think so. There was somebody over here, and then I'll do... I'm at the back of the room. Yes, go ahead.
Can the fiscal sponsor be a charity entity of a large corporation?
Yeah, so it can be any charity that's willing to do it.
Then your people could have the big company's benefits.
They might. That hasn't been traditional, but years ago, along with... I wrote a small book on philanthropy in the business corporation. What I found in those years was that we looked to business corporations for large contributions into the sector, but it's never really happened. It might now. It might now, but for a lot of years it didn't.
Being
yes.
a fiscal sponsor is different than being an employee. I mean, I think that,
oh,
I don't know,
yeah.
I it's not clear to me how an employee of your little entity would get benefits from a corporation. So that's...
I thought the question was if your corporation had a charity.
Well, but they said then you could get benefits from the corporation.
Oh, I see. So there was, you're saying that separation would still be maintained, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Okay,
thank you.
Yes, go ahead.
If you're in the initial phases
next,
waiting
Lisa.
For the 501, if you're in the initial phases waiting for the
501c3,
would you recommend hooking into a corporation? How long does that take, and are there any restrictions on getting grants? I mean, can you still pursue grants?
Usually, your foundations are going to, if it's a grant from a foundation, they're going to want to see the determination letter. If it's a pretty routine application that doesn't hit some of the buttons that the IRS have, it should go through in my experience, and they try to get it through in about 6 months. So I recommend that the minute that you're ready with your package and you be ready to file that 1023 when you get your organization set, so you're trying to make the time as short as you can. Some entities will make a contribution to you, as I said, some donors particularly, knowing they have faith in you, they have faith in the process, and they will make a contribution before you get your letter. But in general. Now, the other thing is that if you are going to operate possibly in a country that's on a bad list, meaning for tourists or something like that, or they are concerned about the IRS, you've hit a button, then what happens is there can be a delay that is, it's their problem, but they talk about it because they haven't figured out how to solve it. They don't have enough experts. They've had a, this is aside from everything, but they've had a hiring freeze for 8 years in the exempt organization division in the IRS. And so that they will, it will go to the national office and it will wait there until the right person who knows the answers to that area will be able to handle it. And then you will get questions and you answer those questions and then you start a dialogue. And generally, you end up getting your exemption. I've never had one turned down in a lot of years of practicing and doing this. And to me, the answer was do your homework on the form, get it right, and try to put your mind where the agent is. And why, well, he's looking at this. He's got his regulations, and you've read those, and you've read the instructions. And give the answer that's the simplest, that makes sense, that is obviously what is the appropriate, honest answer. I'm not, I don't even need to use the word honest, but to, and then you're pretty home free. And 6 months, if you waited a while, you can usually, there's plenty you can do in that time. Yes?
I'm actually a CFO of a 501c3, and it's working, so it can happen.
Good.
the question that we're having now is decisions about where to file to, or where which states to register to do business in.
Yeah.
And two things. What constitutes as doing business? And two, we're actually a religious organization, and a number of states are a little bit more waffly on the definition of religious organization than the IRS is.
Yes.
And they'll just say, if you're a religious organization, you don't need to file.
That's right.
But there's something in me that doesn't quite trust that language.
Yeah, well, there are lots of churches and religious organizations that are not required to file for exemption, but do anyway, because they want that security. The definition of doing business in a state will vary from state to state. I mean, this is what we live with the United States. But in general, it has to do with a bank account, some people there, an office. It's not, California passed a statute that had to do with registration and, I know what it had to do with. It had to do with the way you set your director's compensation, and it was 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And a whole lot of people got very nervous that if I was a foundation in Massachusetts and I was making a grant to a California foundation, did I have to risk? Was I subject to that? The answer is no. Was I Harvard University and I owned some land that somebody had left me in California? And would that get me under it? No. That isn't what we call doing business in any way. And so that it's pretty straightforward. But you need to look at the rules state to state.
Yeah, I think one more question.
Yeah. Okay.
Great. Besides IRS.gov, what specific resources would you recommend for relating to the topic short of coursework? Obviously, that would be best.
Coursework. there's a new one to me that I found very interesting. It's called lawforchange.org. And it has a lot of good information. The Foundation Center has information that's more than for just foundations. Independent Sector has very interesting material on conflict of interest and conflict of interest policy. Those are the ones I would think of. But I think your best resource is that IRS. There is think it's called Charity Governance. Maybe.com. And the author is Jack Segal, S-E-G-A-L. So once you get into one, you'll find some others. And I think we have to stop.
Okay, that's, do you have a minute to hang around and answer a few more questions?
Of course.
Okay, so she's available. Let's thank Mary.